Chapter 47, Temple Builders. Rising to a great height above the city of Jerusalem was the Temple Mount. After the fall of Jerusalem, it was a picture of desolation, and the Jews who had returned from Babylon were pained every time they turned their eyes in its direction. It was easy enough for those far away in Babylon and Egypt to pray with their faces turned toward Jerusalem. Their minds were full of beautiful visions of the magnificent past, but it was quite another thing to lift up hearts of faith and hope when they were face to face with the ruin. The edict of Cyrus kept ringing in their ears. They had left Babylon with all its security and comforts to build up the temple of God. Yet here they had been over a year without doing anything except to build up the altar amid the ruins. It is hard for us to understand what the temple meant to the Hebrew race. Their regard for it amounted to a ruling passion. No matter where they were and under what circumstances, it was the chief center of interest. The great sorrow of the exile was not that they were oppressed in the land of captivity, but that they were distant from the sacred spot where their temple lay in ruins. These people could not build temples as we build churches. As much as they missed the temple while in Babylon, it never occurred to them that they could build one there. In all the wide world, there was only one location, and that in Jerusalem, where their temple could stand. In the second year after their homecoming, they entered upon the work. They were not lacking in means. The rich offerings of their countrymen in Babylon and the temple treasures which Cyrus had delivered over to them had been placed in the king's treasure house in a neighboring country for safekeeping. They had the power to call on the workmen of the Persian king to bring cedars from Lebanon and other material. Besides, there were the liberal free will contributions made by the Jews themselves when they first saw the ruins of Solomon's temple after their return. The old foundation, as solid and massive as it had been, was not fit to build a new structure on, and the ruins had to be cleared away to the bottom. After they had removed the vines and shrubs growing in a tangle over the crumbling walls, and had dug out large forest trees reaching out their wide branches over court and porch, there was all the crumbling masonry to carry away. A great many of the heavy stones, which had been hewn in quarries far away in the time of David and Solomon, were undoubtedly worked over for the new temple. The new foundation was begun amid great rejoicing. The workmen proceeded to the sound of music and praise. When the builders laid the stones, the priests with their trumpets and the Levites with cymbals praised God. The singing was responsive. Give thanks unto Jehovah, for he is good, for his loving kindness endureth forever toward Israel, was sounded back and forth across the temple site. This work was no heavy, unwelcome task, but a labor of love. The workmen were inspired, as well as the many young and old and decrepit who could only stand around on the Temple Mount and cheer the laborers. It is safe to say that an ever-increasing number came to rejoice as stone upon stone was put in place. When the foundation was completed, the people raised a great shout of joy. The temple at last was rising from the ruins. But there were others who did not shout for joy. They were the old men with stooped figure and long white hair and beard, who were always honored and revered by the younger Jews. They had seen the Temple of Solomon in its majesty and matchless beauty, and the difference filled them with sorrow. While others were shouting for joy, they wept with a loud voice, so that the voice of gladness and of grief was heard at a great distance. Josephus, the great Jewish historian, tells us that the noise of trumpets and cymbals, of singing and weeping, was heard in the land of Israel where lived the Samaritans. This seems absurd to us until we learn that the land of the Jews extended only 4 or 5 miles north of Jerusalem at this time. These outsiders hurried to Jerusalem, full of curiosity to see what was taking place. When they saw that a temple was being built where so long had lain the ruins of the old one, they asked to be allowed to assist. These people, known in the New Testament as Samaritans, were made up of different classes. When the 10 tribes who had been carried away so long before by the Assyrians, the conquerors had brought in foreign tribes to take their place. Other foreigners had come in at different times, and besides, there were a few left of the 10 tribes. The descendants of all these were called the Samaritans. They claimed to be worshippers of God, and they were, when everything was favorable to that worship. Now when they heard that a great temple was being built, and that Cyrus the Great was in sympathy with the undertaking, they became very anxious to have a part in it. The Jews had no faith in this people, and their leader, Zerubbabel, gave a blunt refusal. He told them that this was a work for the Jews only, and that they had nothing whatever to do with it. The Samaritans departed with angry looks. The imprudence of such a manner was soon seen. Enmity was stirred up, and these neighbors became a great hindrance to the success of the work. They became so hostile that one of the prophets says that there was no safety to him that went out or came in because of the adversary. Discouragement followed the laying of the foundation. Crops failed in drought or were destroyed by mildew and beaten down by hail. There were no improvements made, and so no hire for man nor any hire for beast. And all the time their enemies were vexing them. Zeal for temple building was at a low ebb, and finally the people concluded that they had been mistaken, and that the time had not yet come for the house of the Lord to be built. The new Persian king had been influenced by the false reports of the enemy, and he issued an order that the work should be stopped, and the people dropped back, discouraged. The Phoenician workmen had long before been dismissed, and the cedar trees from Lebanon lay idly waiting for better days. Time went by until 16 years had passed since Cyrus had electrified the Jews of Babylon with his great edict, but nothing had been done towards building the temple except the foundation. Prophets became active. They pointed to the Lord's house lying in ruins while the people lived in comfortable homes. These temple builders needed encouragement. The prophet Haggai came to them with splendid visions of the new temple, which to them seemed so commonplace and insignificant. It was to surpass the old one in glory, he said. The most patriotic period of Jewish history was yet to come, and this temple was to be the center of interest and inspiration. The builders were working with new hope when another difficulty arose. Tattenai, the Persian governor, came to visit Jerusalem, and he was surprised to find the people working on a great temple. It appeared such a stronghold on that high hill that it might just as easily become a citadel or fortress. He was not sure that the people had any right to build anything which looked so threatening, and he asked by whose authority they were doing it. When the Jewish leaders informed him that Cyrus the Great had given them permission, he dared not do anything to hinder the work. But as a faithful officer, he felt that he must report the matter to the present king, Darius II. The Persian king at once set to work to find this edict of Cyrus, about which his governor had written when he told about the temple building. Finally, the edict was found in Ecbatana. There, in emphatic terms, appeared the wishes of Cyrus that the Jews be allowed to return to Jerusalem for the purpose of building up the temple. Darius had the greatest regard for the wishes of Cyrus, and he sent a reply to his governor not only to let them go on with the work, but even to give them all the aid they needed. The grave danger which had threatened them really turned out to be a decided gain. The people worked on with increased zeal, and in 4.5 years the temple was ready for dedication. Never was any temple or church dedicated with greater joy and gratitude. A history of the temples would be a history of the Jewish people. All changes in the nation were reflected in their place of worship. When God-fearing kings ruled, and they were strong as well as good, the prosperity of the nation was seen in the temple in full repair, with the treasures all restored in the coffers full of wealth. The great feast days were observed in a splendid way, and daily services were held. The priests were zealous and faithful, and the people were ready to worship with reverence. When the weak and idolatrous kings followed, at once there was a change. The great feast days had less interest to the people. The treasures were used for other purposes. The high places became popular. The temple began to look neglected. The faithful priests were kept in the background, and sometimes idols were set up in the temple. And under one king, at least, who did not use the temple for idols, the doors were nailed up and the public ceased to worship there. Then some great disaster to the nation would follow, and the temple would be robbed of its wealth to pay a war debt, while the nation as a vassal became weaker and weaker. This had been the story of the old temple, and the new one was to have experiences of a similar kind. But no more were rulers of the house of David to sacrifice to idols. This temple stood 500 years, until the time when Herod the Great replaced it with one of greater magnificence. Solomon's had withstood the many attacks of enemies almost as long. The temple built by Herod the Great was 40 years in building, and it had been completed but a few years when it was razed to the ground by the Roman general Titus.